So tell me about the history of the burrito. I'm Joe Seemantle, and welcome to Raven Conversations. And today I'm joined by Staff Sergeant Kim Marble, who I shockingly, as we were talking just before this, we've met, but not in an Army sense. We both coach youth sports.
Correct.
And we live in the same town, which fantastic, Rainier, Washington. If you've never been, it's a fantastic
place.
But you are an all source analyst, with 156 Information Battalion. You also work at the counter drug, program here at Camp Murray, and Spanish speaker. And you're here to talk today about kind of your background and, Hispanic Heritage Month. So I appreciate you coming on and joining us.
Thank you, sir. I joined the Guard in January of 2020, but I did 7 years of active duty first. Never plan on joining the Guard, but I wish I would have sooner. I didn't know that what I wanted to do the whole time was in the Guard. So it was kind of, I don't know, I kind of think it was just like fate at that point. Things weren't where I thought things were all aligning for me in active duty. They all kind of fell apart at the same time here at Fort Lewis, JBLM. And I just... I did the try one. That was the incentive at the time, was you could do try 1 year with the Guard, a 1 year contract, no strings attached, and you'd get 6 months free of TRICARE. And I'd figure that'd be a perfect transition. Mm-hmm. You know, I could figure out what I'm going to do in the civilian life. And my kids would still be covered with insurance, because that was a big focus for me, was the insurance. I had a job right out of active duty with the state, so I wasn't necessarily worried, but it was still that transitioning point. And then just like abruptly leaving the Army was a big scary thing when the Army does provide so much for you. I did the try one. I chose Bravo Company 156 because it was the only thing on the list offered to me that I knew was not an S2 section. And I loved what I learned in the IO. Then 2020 was kind of a crazy year. So just learning the Guard, transitioning between active duty to the Guard, being a civilian, that civilian soldier life plus COVID plus like just life happening around me. It was a really big transitioning point. And then I got a text message. Hey, you speak Spanish and you're an intel analyst. Would you be interested in applying for counter drug? Sure. I don't know what that is, but why not?
So for those that don't know, and I don't think we've ever talked about counter drug on here, what is the counter drug program?
So every U.S. state and territory has a counter drug program that works with local law enforcement agencies. Here in Washington, we are fortunate enough that not only do we have the state plans that every state and territory has that works with local law enforcement agencies, but we also have the schoolhouse that teaches regional courses, whether anything related to narcotics to our surrounding law enforcement agencies. They also travel throughout the region to provide classes. And then we also have the federal program only, I believe, 5 states are fortunate enough to have. And I think we have the second largest, which is a big kudos to us and the hard work that we put out. The program and all its members work really hard. It's just countering narcotics, whether it's here within our state, supporting the local law enforcement agencies with analysis at their request. And then on the federal mission, obviously that's higher level. So it's a little more aggravated and a little more up there. But
yeah. Did you know what the program was prior?
I had no idea. Never heard of it. I knew when I was active duty, I did have a human chief warrant officer that like rolled through, and he's like, yeah, I just came from Fort Bliss and I did all this stuff, counter border operations with all these Spanish linguists, and it was really cool. And you know, they need 35 foxes. Oh yeah, but they're only in the Guard. And I was like, what?
You're like, what?
What did I sign up for? Like, why am I here, you know, doing motor pool duty and like going to the field all the time? And like, it just didn't make any sense to me because I, you know, they have all these stigmas about the guard and the weakened warrior and whatnot. And I was like, that sounds like they're doing exactly what I want to be doing. So that was the only time I ever had like the reference to it. I had one of the Sergeant First classes in Bravo Company, like, send out this message that was a member of the counter drug program and say like, hey, would you be interested? And I applied. I got the job. And I've learned every single day because I don't work in the all source analyst lane. I work as a linguist and started doing SIGINT and never done that before. I came from a tactical experience. I came from Striker land and Apache land. So just very, very different hands-on operations, mission planning, battle damage assessment, all that stuff, and never knew this existed. It's super cool, super fun. Had I known it existed, I wouldn't have re-enlisted twice in active duty. But I think everything got me here because one of those re-enlistments is what brought me to JBLM. And through that process, it's how I decided to stay in Washington, and it's how I decided to do a try one with the guard, you know, so I think everything worked out for the best. And had I not had the experience, the tactical hands-on experience I had, on my previous deployment and whatnot, I wouldn't necessarily been the best candidate for the role in counter drug.
Yeah. So this kind of leads into my next question. That's you talk about the try one. For those that don't know, that's really just if you're prior service, and it's a way to learn about the guard, come into the guard and see if it's a good fit. So how did you learn about that and learn about the guard?
So I'll be honest, I was going to switch to the Air Force. I didn't have the best experience my last year in active duty. Some failed leadership experiences and just I didn't feel a member of the team anymore where I came from. Like, it was super high morale. We had some leadership changes and then things just really declined. And that happens in a lot of units. And one thing led to another. And I was like, well, maybe I should give the Air Force a shot. You know, that's what my before coming into the Army, previous family members had said, you know, if you're going to do it, join the Air Force. You know, they're better. And I was like, no, I'm pretty set on the Army. But I did reach out to a recruiter. They just gave me the runaround. You know, they didn't let me pick my job, which I thought was really weird. And I didn't like that. So I went green. I love the Army. I love every bit of it. And then same thing. I was getting out of regular Army. And I was like, okay, I'll give this Air Force thing a shot again, or the Air Guard. And the runaround, here we go again. All I had to do with the Army was give my PT test, my current PT test, and sign the 1-year contract. And that was it, you know, and it was simple. It was easy. And I appreciated that. So I felt that was the best option for me at that point. And then it was 1 year, simple enough. And it gave me that time to make a good decision.
Yeah, no, it's a term that I've heard kind of throughout my whole guard career. I've known a lot of people to do the try ones, and then the try one turns into try six.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden you're here 20 years later.
Yep, I'm on that try six right now.
which for you is great. You know, as I mentioned earlier when we started the video, we've met through youth sports. You coach basketball. I coached basketball this last year, and you've done it for a couple of years now. How'd you get into coaching youth sports?
Prior to the Army, I'm from California originally. I have been coaching sports since like rec sports and rec leagues and whatnot since like high school. I've always been an athlete. I've always loved it. I went to college. I still helped out within the community there. And now that I built my own little community in Rainier and I have my own kids, obviously it's a small town. They need a little more help, a little more assistance. And I love it. And I want my boys to love the sports that I love. And I want them to try and like have confidence and whatnot. And I want that for other kids too. I want them to feel a safe space to like learn, and develop. and I figure I'm a good coach for that. So I gave it a shot and I enjoy it. And yeah, so that's how I got into it. I just, something I'd done before and I just got back into it.
Yeah. It's always fun. Like I was saying earlier, I've done it for a few years. I think I'm on my fourth year doing it. Sadly, this was the last year with my son. He's now just junior high period. And I, knowing myself and my daughter, we will probably argue if I try to coach her, but we'll see how that goes when she gets older. So originally I wanted to talk about, Hispanic Heritage Month. You were brought to me by one of my soldiers on the M-Day side, Staff Sergeant Vincent, who you served with at 156. Mm-hmm. She's now over in the 122nd with me. Briefly explain, you know, you're a Spanish speaker, you have a background, obviously with family, Hispanic Heritage Month. What is it and why is it important to celebrate?
So Hispanic Heritage Month. So yes, I am a Spanish speaker, and while, appearances aren't everything, I don't usually get pinpointed out as being Mexican, but, my mother is from Mexico. I was raised in a very traditional, like, Mexican Catholic home. And my family, the vast majority of my mother's side, are all migrant field workers. So Hispanic Heritage Month, why September? September 16th is, the Mexican Independence Day. And I think it kind of just aligned with, you know, honorary months that we have here in the U.S. Also back in during the strikes of the field workers and whatnot, we have Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta that, mm-hmm. you know, they fought for the rights of the field workers and the migrants. There's been a long history of migrants in the U.S. where, you know, now there's a lot of political terms around it and a lot of, like, whether it's right or wrong. But if we link back to original treaties and border crossings and whatnot, like when farming first took off in, you know, the Southwest, in the West period in California, the workers were the original people that, like, lived here, you know, and they were of the original Mexico. They worked the land, they knew how to do it, and therefore they got hired by, like, the original, like, farmers of those areas. Fast forward to, like, the 1900s, the Bracero program was a sanctioned program where men would come over from Mexico during the farming season, work, and then return to their homes. There was no, it wasn't migrating or immigrating or anything like that. It was just come work and go back home and for the season. And that was completely, totally fine. And then even in my early upbringing, in the 90s, like, multiple of my family members would come and go throughout the year. And it was just like a fluid movement, like in early March, late February, you'd see, like, people start coming across the border in Arizona and, like TJ, and then November, everybody's, like, going back home. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like, a thing, you know, that was the Hispanic culture, you know, but September, I think it just kind of lands as Hispanic Heritage Month because of Mexican Independence Day being the 16th. And for me, that's a big thing. We don't necessarily celebrate it here, but I mean, my whole life on the TV, you get it's called El Grito. And I'm sure if people have heard, like, mariachi music or anything, mm-hmm. you've heard the cry, you know, the yell that, like, is the typical, like, Mexican sound that people associate with. And that's what happens at midnight on Mexican Independence Day. They'll, you know, in Mexico City, like, everybody congregates around, like, the main square, and the flags are flying. The president has a little speech, and then fireworks happen, and everybody does a grito. And it's big, it's beautiful, it's culture. And I think that it's beautiful that we can still celebrate that here. Especially growing up in California, you know, a lot of people, like, joke that it's, you know, still Mexico because of how many Hispanic people still live there, and how many people migrate there. But it's always been like that. Like, I never saw it as, like, being something different or mm-hmm. weird. It was just how it is. But it's not just Mexican cultures. We have so many cultures there. It's very diverse. And I think everything gets celebrated pretty equally.
Yeah. And I think, we look at the U.S. military, we're very much a melting pot of a society. And you're absolutely right. Hispanic heritage is across our military. It's got a lot of, you know, a lot of folks in the military are of Hispanic heritage. What does it mean to be a service member and celebrate that and be able to share that with those that are not?
Yeah, I never have felt that my Hispanic culture has been suppressed in any way. Usually it's a shock to people when, you know, they hear me speak Spanish or something. And I'm not like offended by it or anything. And I think that's been really great as far as the military. We were actually talking about it at work the other day that at basic training, I had to translate for Puerto Ricans. We speak Spanish. Well, we don't speak the same Spanish. And, you know, I'd be doing pushups because I couldn't tell the drill sergeant what they're telling me. Like, I could tell them what the drill sergeant's saying, but I couldn't give the answer back because it just wasn't.
It's not the same.
Yeah, it's not the same.
I imagine there's different dialogues. And yeah. Different countries have different ways of saying things.
Yeah, very different dialects, very different accents. Slang is different. Just how things are said, and you have the ear for it, el oído. And I just didn't have the ear for Puerto Rican Spanish. It grew over the course of time. And then even in AIT, I had to translate for a couple other Puerto Ricans, and one was sat between me and then another student that was of Colombian descent. And with her help, I could, like, she was like that median point for me. Like, she would say something and it was still a little off for me, but I could understand what she was saying enough to then be able to like break apart with the Puerto Rican, because he had a super thick accent. And then that's kind of where it started like raising for me. And then, you know, throughout my different units and everything with Dominicans and Cubans and Argentinians, just people from all over, like, it's just been so beautiful to like always get together, and we all wear the same uniform, and you know, at the end of the day we're different but we're the same, and we have like shared experiences, and we can all kind of like go back to that Hispanic culture. We all kind of have like those same upbringings, and so that's always been like a really like fun thing that, you know, when I was growing up, I only thought Mexicans spoke Spanish, you know? And then I remember like in basic training, like people from the East Coast saying like, oh, you're Spanish. And I'm like, no, I'm not Spanish. I'm Mexican American, you know, I'm not from Spain. And it was really weird to me, but that's how they say it in their area. You know, like people are Spanish. And then in other areas like, oh, you're Hispanic. And, you know, in some places like that's not necessarily a respectful thing to say. So it was just like, wait, no, I'm not, you know? So it was kind of like just those different identities and just how different areas and people from different walks of life, different regions of the United States, how we all kind of come together and we're all the same. It's so different and it's still celebrated.
Yeah. And I think you explain that in a way where somebody who does not come from a Hispanic culture, I can totally hear the passion and enjoyment for your background and your family's background. And it's amazing. And honestly, I don't really have any other questions because I think you've explained everything perfectly. But I think one of my big questions would be, is there anything special that you and your family do to celebrate that month?
I think for me and my family, it's always been about like the migrant field workers. So like as a younger person, when I was like in college and in high school, it was about like the marches for field workers and just honoring our people and the struggles that they have gone through. Not necessarily in a sense of like trying to stand out or trying to get something, but just the fact that like they work very, very hard. And it often goes unnoticed. You have all this like produce in your stores and, you'd never really give it a second thought as like, how did this tomato get here? Or how did this apricot get here? You know? And it's like somebody picked that with their hands. And it's backbreaking labor. It's hot. Myself and four of my other cousins, like, we have now taken that hard work that our parents have done out in the fields, and we have joined the United States military. You know, we've taken all their work and their sacrifice, and we've honored our family and their name and done something to be proud of. And that's not something a lot of people do, but that's what our parents wanted for us. You know, they did all the sacrifice. They worked so hard so that we could have something else. And I think that often goes unnoticed. And so that's what Hispanic Heritage Month means to me, is that it's knowing your heritage, but looking at the future. Yeah. And I don't think, I think that's one of the beautiful things about being Mexican and being raised in California, being Cali grown is what we like to call it, because everything's grown in California. That's good. Avocados. And it's like, you just, it's very diverse. You learn a lot about others, but you're able to fully embrace who you are, and it's okay. And I think that allowed me to be comfortable enough to, when the time came, be the first girl in my family to say, I'm going to join the Army, because that wasn't typically something girls do in our family. And my family completely supported it, because it was something to be proud of.
Yeah. So while we're also talking, you had mentioned about the history of the burrito. You were willing to share it. Would love to know about the history of the burrito besides being delicious.
Yes. So, again, Mexicans, Mexican Americans, we have a lot of pride, and that's something amongst all Hispanic Latinos. Like, everybody has something that they're proud of, but in Sonora, Mexico, the north, the state that is, across the northern, the Arizona border, we are known for our flour tortillas. And so where everybody else makes corn tortillas, in Sonora, you can get them from any size, from a very, very small street taco size to as large as a pizza. They're very thin. And so the burrito, for all those wonderful field workers, the reason why the strikes started occurring and why the walkouts happened was they weren't getting lunches. There was no bathroom breaks, stuff like that. So what the women started doing was making the tortillas bigger so that their food could all be carried in one. So they made the tortillas bigger, and they put the rice and the beans and the meat and the salsa all in one. They wrapped it up. And then that way you had it in one hand ready to go, and you didn't have to stop to pull out your plate and eat your lunch.
Yeah, and like mix it right there in the field. It's all in one.
Yep. So that's what they did. They just made the tortillas bigger, and there you got the burrito.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you coming on. When you had mentioned Cali grown, you know, being from California, my wife is also from Southern California. And just hearing her stories, because she always tells me, I grew up a minority out in Southern California. And I always kind of looked at her like, I don't know about that. Like, but I mean, you kind of explained it right there too. It's mostly, it's a mixed culture down in Southern California. And so I think you almost helped shed some light on my own wife's story as well, which is really great. So
pretty much anywhere in California. Like,
yeah. So I appreciate you coming on. Anything else you want to add or?
No, I'm okay.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks again for coming on. If you like the conversation, give it a like. If you want to know more, leave a comment in the section there below, and subscribe for future videos. Appreciate it.
Thanks, sir.